Welcome to this edition of the Pepperdine People Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Gibson. This series captures some of the outstanding learning and outreach opportunities available here at Pepperdine. Each episode features interviews with exceptional members of our community and the special people who visit our campus.
Thank you for joining us for episode number 20 of Pepperdine People. I'm Ted Garcia, and I'm joined today by Hector Tobar, who is a very well-respected, award-winning journalist and a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So the reason that we're having you here is to talk about Latino Heritage Month and something yes, that we're talking about here at Pepperdine. But before we get into that, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your background. You are a native Angeleno, from what I understand.
Yes, I am.
Tell me, where did you grow up and what was your childhood like?
I grew up in East Hollywood, California, by the corner of Hollywood and Western, near where there's a metro station now.
Which is now kind of Koreatown, isn't it?
No, it's actually called Little Armenia.
That's it. Okay.
It's a part of the city that, yes, I think say there is a probably a large Korean population, but an even larger Armenian population and a Central American population. When I was growing up there, it was a very diverse community. Filipino, some Latinos, a lot of Eastern European kids, Lebanese, everything. It was really sort of a melting pot. And in fact, in our neighborhood, James Earl Ray lived in our neighborhood the week before he went to go assassinate Martin Luther King. I mean, wow. It was a place that was very transient. But, you know, for us, it was our home and it was a really cool place to live and our playground.
Tell me about your parents.
My parents are immigrants from Guatemala. They arrived in 1962, the same year that the theme building was opened at LAX, those two arches that are there. And they arrived as teenagers. My mother was pregnant and they were escaping sort of after a shotgun wedding in Guatemala City. They arrived with tourist visas and stayed for the next 30, 40 years.
So they're still – are they still
– Oh, no. They're U.S. and they became naturalized. Yes. Right. My mother actually returned to Guatemala about 10 years ago, but they both very soon – in those days, it was very easy to become a naturalized citizen. And within 7 years, we're both U.S. citizens. In fact, one of my earlier childhood memories is of standing in the naturalization ceremony with them as they took the oath to become American citizens.
So when we talk about Latino heritage, you really, really lived – Latino heritage. I mean, you're like first generation American.
That's
basically.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I never really thought of it that way when I was growing up. I just thought of myself as someone of Guatemalan descent who was born in Los Angeles, the city with the greatest baseball team on earth. You know, I was number one a Dodger fan, and number two Guatemalan, and number three American. You know, I think, or maybe not necessarily in that order. So, yeah, that was my how I grew up. And then when I came back to the city in the 1980s after going away to college, I came back in the late 80s. Of course, Los Angeles had undergone this incredible transformation. Mm-hmm. And Los Angeles was in the process of becoming a Latin American city. I think it's pretty undeniable that in a certain sense, part of Los Angeles, a big chunk of Los Angeles is in Latin America, culturally speaking.
When you were grade school, high school, did you have a direction? Did you know what you wanted to do? Did your parents kind of encourage you to go a certain way, or were you always thinking, I really want to be a journalist?
No, I never had any idea that I would become either a journalist or a writer. I mean, there were no journalists or writers in my family. My father worked in hotels. My maternal grandfather was a bricklayer, and my other grandfather was a campesino, a peasant. So I didn't really have any idea that I could ever become a writer. My dad especially encouraged me to go to college, mm-hmm. and I thought I would be either a doctor or something like that, and then I drifted towards history. But I didn't have any role models to become a writer. It really wasn't until maybe I was like 23 or 24 that I had the idea that I'd actually want to be a writer for a living.
Where did you go to college?
I went to UC Santa Cruz.
Okay.
It's kind of the –
The Slugs?
Yes. They're both – like Pepperdine, it's on the coast, but it's probably couldn't be more different than Pepperdine University.
In many ways.
Yeah.
what did you study in college?
I basically majored in sociology and Latin American studies, but I majored really in it was really political economy and social movements is what I studied.
What did you want to do with that?
I wanted to change the world.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that was my mission. My mission was that I would be one of the members of that, you know, little cadre of intellectuals who would lead, you know, California, you know, in a certain direction, let's put it that way. But, you know, I met a lot of leftists when I was in the Bay Area, and they just seemed to be like a real deficit in a sense of humor. And so that kind of led me away from seeking that as a profession until one day I started volunteering at a community newspaper, and I just became a gatherer of stories, and that's sort of where my journalism career started.
Lofty goal, changing, you know, the world. That's a big goal.
Yeah, especially in the early 1980s, not really many people had that idea. I think that was sort of passé by then, right? Everybody had tried that. It had failed, and they were all trying to make money. But I don't know. I caught the tail end of that, I guess.
So fast forwarding just a little bit, how did you end up at the Times?
I was the editor of a community newspaper called El Tecolote, and I had also been an intern at the Center for Investigative Reporting. And I knew several people who had applied for internships at the LA Times, and so I applied for one. And I got in 1988. And then I became a full-time staff member not long afterwards, and then a Metro reporter, and then I stayed there for 5 years, and then I left the paper and I went to get a master's degree.
Great. So when you were at the Times in the 80s, was there a lot of diversity at the Times at the time?
There was starting to be some diversity. There was. In fact, there maybe even was more diversity then than there is now.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It was, you know, there was MetPro, which I had gone through, which was the minority editorial training program. There was a general realization that daily journalism was a profession that had perhaps integrated less slowly than other professions, and that you really couldn't write about a city like Los Angeles or Baltimore or New York or any other major American city without having eyes and ears that were in tune to all the different cultures of the city. And so it was becoming a more diverse place. It was becoming – it still wasn't – there was still a lot of resentment towards those of us who were the young, you know, minorities. Of course, now, you know, we're not minorities anymore, but at least in LA. But there was a lot of resentment then. It was sort of a tough time because there was a lot of unspoken resentment towards us as young reporters.
Well, young upcoming reporters energy and a spark and a drive.
Right. I think there's always resentment towards young upcoming reporters no matter where.
I think that is very true. One thing I always like to ask people is whether you think your background, your Latino background, gave you an advantage or a disadvantage on your way up.
I think it was absolutely an advantage.
Okay.
Because first of all, because I could see stories that other people couldn't. And so I brought with me not just my education, not just my degrees, not just my ability to write, but I also brought this vision of a reality that I had lived and that other people had not, and that reality was there in the city. And so I made my name by – One of the ways I made my name early was by doing stories that had a certain depth and texture to them about the community that I was from that hadn't really been in the paper so much before. And I did them at the same time with this desire to master the craft of journalism, right? And so I was really serious about the craft. And I think those two things together really helped me. It didn't hold me back, I think, because I didn't care what anybody thought of me, because I thought I was good enough to be there.
What about discrimination? Did you ever run into anything like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I ran into people, not necessarily discrimination where I was denied a job because of my ethnicity, but I would run into just resentments, you know, people saying, well, you're just here because you're brown-skinned, and that would happen.
Or because of your last name.
Or your last name, right, or whatever. But I think the quality of my work sort of silenced a lot of those critics, because I had an idea then of what a reporter should be, which is sort of still an idea at the LA Times, which is that you could do anything. So you could be – you had to be a generalist, and you had to be fast. You also had to be a good feature writer. You had to be a good reporter, a good investigative reporter. So for example, one of the first – I did two series of stories that really sort of defined my early career. Besides doing these stories about immigration and then about homelessness, I did a whole series on the incarceration of the mentally ill, which didn't have anything to do with the Latino community, but just showed my curiosity in general about the city And I think that it was my understanding that I wasn't just there to be a Latino reporter, but I was there to be a reporter, and I was there to be a witness to life in my city that really carried me forward. Because if I had just tried to do that one thing that I brought, then because of my cultural background, then I think I would have really marginalized myself pretty quickly. But I didn't just do that. I became a good rewrite man. I was the lead rewrite man mm-hmm. on many a disaster. So it was bringing all those skills together that I think kept me from being marginalized.
You said – did you say there were two stories that are
– Oh, and I also did a series – I'm sorry.
On, that's okay. That's
housing inspection. Here. Housing inspection.
Okay.
And the deficiencies of the city housing inspection process, and how there were just many slums that were just inspected over and over again, and it was just pro forma, and the inspection process really wasn't doing its job. And that led to some reforms and a couple of properties that were taken over that I wrote about that I'm pretty proud of, actually, because I can drive by them and I can see that there's no more lead paint on the walls, and it's because I did a couple of stories.
Well, see, now that takes a lot of digging.
It takes a lot of
man hours. It takes a lot of phone calls and knocking on doors. And, a lot of people, especially these days, aren't up for that.
Right.
They get on the internet and they copy and paste, and that's their story.
Right. And that's, I think, the difference between journalism and blogging. That there's this craft that has been handed down it's basically a century or two of American journalism. And there was a whole, in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s still, and there is still today, this whole sort of Stations of the Cross that you went through as a reporter. You started off on night cops and then you went to day cops, and then you might cover City Hall, and then you cover courts. You learn how to cover a trial. You learn how to go, the joys of hours spent in archives, of court archives.
Sure.
Those things are tools of inquiry and tools really of citizenship, because they teach you how to exercise your right as both a citizen and as a journalist to access information. It's something really precious that we have as Americans, and that we have this profession, daily journalism and television journalism, that is really sort of based, that actually has an economic model that's mm-hmm. built on the spirit of inquiry. That sells this product. It's one of the things that makes the United States a great country. And I've also been a foreign correspondent and lived in countries where there isn't that sort of robust journalistic culture,
right.
where there isn't that, the Freedom of Information Act. And there is a big difference. It's one of the things that makes the United States a really good place to live.
Let's talk about you won a big, huge award in the early 90s.
Yes.
That I'm sure you must be proud of.
Well, it was myself and a staff of reporters, but I was one of the people out there on the streets covering that. So I feel proud about that, yes.
That was and I never know whether to say Pulitzer or Pulitzer. I never know which is correct.
Neither do I.
And you have one. How did that come about?
Well, I was the LA Times Metro staff in those days was an amazing staff. I mean, it still is, but we had people now who have gone throughout the entire profession. And for example, we had Mark Lacey, who is now – the Mexico City bureau chief for the New York Times. He was a Metro reporter, and Ginger Thompson was on the Metro staff mm-hmm. also. I was there, and George Ramos, who's now the journalism director over at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. We just had Charisse Jones, amazing reporter who later went to USA Today. We had a very, very diverse staff, and it was an incredible editors. And so we had prepared really thoroughly for the Rodney King verdict, because the Rodney King verdict was coming down. I was doing, for I don't know what reason, I was doing rewrite on the Copt React story. And so we had one of our best reporters, Sean Hubler, was going to go to these police stations in South Central. And she called in. The verdict came down, and I remember sending a text message to – in those days, text message on our computer systems
right.
to one of our editors saying, I think I better get my asbestos suit ready. And he says, do you really think it's going to get that bad? And I think – yes, I said, I think it is. And about an hour later, I was calling Sean Hubler, my reporter on the field for the material from the police station, and she was saying, I just drove through Florence and Normandy, and they stoned the car. And the city was beginning to erupt. And in fact, the riot actually reached the Los Angeles Times. They were stoning they were throwing stones at the building because there was a riot at Parker Center and it spread. We won the Pulitzer not for that night but for the next day. The next day, the city had burned during the night and we were going to do a series of stories once again. I mean, the Times at that time, we would come out with a budget of stories, 10 stories long. That would be the main bar, the main story, which have a bunch of reporters assigned to it. And I was assigned to one of the side stories, which was on the economic impact of what had happened the night before.
Right.
So I went out to the street, and at those days, I was a pretty fearless street reporter. So I drove down to the area that had burned and I started asking people questions, and pretty soon you just hear the fire sirens. And to make a long story short, I started off in South Los Angeles somewhere by Manchester and I don't know where, and I followed the fires and the sirens all the way north through Koreatown, and I ended up in Echo Park and Silver Lake. Oh. I went actually in Hollywood. I saw fires and looting at the old Sears on Santa Monica and somewhere. I followed this whole thing north and I phoned in all of my notes from all the different places that I was. I covered a lot of territory that day and it was one of those things where you know you're seeing history happen. And I remember, for example, being in Koreatown and calling and seeing looting going on and calling and saying, Koreatown is burning. Did you know that? Send somebody out here. And they sent somebody out to Koreatown, and I just kept on going further north. So it was something where I had been covering homelessness and poverty and the Latinoization of the big chunks of the city for 3 or 4 years before that. So I sort of felt like this is something that I sort of could see that was going to happen. It was just this expression of frustration, and it was a really important moment in the history of the city. It was sort of the end of everyone embracing immigration. It was the end of the old LAPD and the birth of a new LAPD. Lots of things changed in those days. And so I felt good what I had done. I was a little frustrated that afterwards I wasn't allowed to write and tell that story. I was treated more as a reporter. They asked me to go find looters and whatnot. But for that day, I was very, very proud of what we accomplished.
It's a big accomplishment.
Yeah.
So you're an author.
I've written a couple of books, yes.
You're a writer. You are a journalist. What can't you do? I don't know. And you're also going to be speaking about Latino heritage.
Yes. It's
got to be kind of an honor for you to actually, you know, be able to talk about this to students who might not know much about Latino heritage at all.
Wow.
Kind of daunting.
I never really think of it that way. I always think that in my audience there are people who have some common experiences, which I think is probably true. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of what I like to speak about these days is American identity, and those things that unite us. And these days, a lot of my spiel really is that there are many things about the common Latin American experience that seem foreign to people, that seem strange. But really, it is just another chapter in this American story. A lot of people think there are conspiracies to change the country with Latin American immigrants. But then a lot of people thought there were conspiracies to change the country with German immigrants in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a theory once that circulated about the time of the Civil War that German immigration was a plot. German and Irish immigration was a plot to take over the United States, and that the German and Irish Catholic immigrants were going to bring the Pope to Cincinnati and reestablish the Vatican in Cincinnati. So I feel part of my job is – well, my job is always just to tell the truth.
Yeah.
And my job is to listen to people. And so that's what I try to do now as a columnist is I try to impart the fullness of the experience and not just focus in on this sort of stereotype that people focus in on about Latino immigration.
Well, we're lucky to have you here. Thank you very much for joining us. And just to recap, we've been joined by Hector Tobar, who's an award-winning columnist with the LA Times. And again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
No problem. I'm Ted Garcia, and thanks for listening.